rock solid. Oh, you lovers, stand with me. Rise in spirit. Oh, you lovers, rise in me. Sing together. Oh, you lovers, sing with me.
This is T. Thorne Coyle with Elemental Castings, my bi-weekly tour through the elements of life, air, fire, water, earth, and ether. Today we have a really special podcast. We recorded a panel from Pantheacon, the massive pagan convention that happens yearly in San Jose, California. I put together a panel with myself, Diana Paxson, Christopher Penzack, Evo Dominguez Jr., and Lon Milo Duquette, with Stephanie Taylor moderating. And our discussion was on the non-dual, polytheism, and contemporary magic. Is the divine one, zero, many, none, or all of the above? And in this conversation that lasts, probably an hour and a half, we went through a theological range attempting to touch on limitlessness, on not this, not that, what the Hindus call neti neti, work with deity, how deity shapes our lives and our relationships. And it was a very interesting conversation that probably could have gone on for 3 or 4 hours, but all we had was an hour and a half. I hope you enjoy it. And here we go.
Well, thank you all for coming to hear this distinguished panel of authors today talk about their views on deity and the divine, and whether or not it is one, many, or as Thorne might say, zero. So I'm going to go ahead and introduce them. And let me start with Thorne. This is Thorne T. Coyle, author of Kissing the Limitless, founder of Solar Cross and the Morning Star Mystery School. Next, we have Diane Paxton, author of Transportation, Elder in the Thoth Deck. Elder in the Troth. How's that? And Christopher Penzick, author of The Living Temple of Witchcraft and Teacher and Healer. And we have Evo Dominguez Jr., author of Spirit Speak, Elder of the Assembly of the Sacred Wheel, and Lon Milo Duquette, author of Enochian Vision Magic, Bishop of EGC, and High Mucky Muck of OTO. We're going to start with each author talking about their theosophy of how they feel about the divine, and then we're going to open it up for questions to the audience. So, Thorne, would you like to start?
Sure. Let's all take a breath together.
Inhale. Everybody. Come on, I can't see you breathing out there.
Inhale. Let it out.
Let's take another one. In and out. Okay.
So I'd like to start by saying, Holy Mother, in whom we live, move, and have our being, from you all things emerge, and unto you all things return. Open our hearts this blessed day, touch our bodies and our minds, walk with us through the gates of power, in shadow and starlight, in fire meeting earth, in the wind on the ocean, and the sweet kiss of life. Blessed be our journey. I'm a skeptical mystic. I'm an intellectual who has fought her mysticism for large portions of her life and now have been forced by circumstances and evidence of my experience to embrace my mysticism. So for me, I often say I'm a non-dualistic polytheist. What does that mean? It means I believe and experience the great zero, that God herself, who is actually pre-gender, of course, putting a name God herself is just convenient for my human mind. God herself is the great zero, the fabric of all, and that fabric of love, and that fabric connects us all. That fabric is immanence and not really transcendence, because it includes everything. And I have a theory about monotheism and where I feel it went off the rails was because they didn't have the concept of zero yet. All they had was one, and they were trying to get at unity. But as soon as you name something one, it makes it a separate entity. And then you get things like conflating the limitless with desert gods like Yahweh, and you're in trouble. I also have an experience and a belief that in that fabric of non-duality, there's multiplicity. Because here we are all sitting in this room, human and divine. And that includes non-corporeal spirits and entities, and that also includes things that we call gods and goddesses, which my experience and theology is that these are forces, cosmic forces in the universe and on Earth that we can relate to in their various functions. From this great non-dual, there are what I call God rays. There are rays of energy, rays of forces that come closer to the material and manifest world and then translate out differently into different cultures. It's why we see similarities in deities in India with deities in Germany, with deities in Ireland, with deities in Persia. They're not the same gods, because they are separate, just like we are separate. We've all grown up in different cultures, yet we're all human. So my theory, my working theory and experience with deity is that these separate deities share similarities because they come from a similar god ray. Again, language is a convenience for trying to wrap my human finite brain around these large forces that come from this great infinite non-dual. So in that way, I'm not a hard polytheist. I don't believe in complete separation ever. I believe, though, that there is separation and there is distinction, and that causes the diversity that is necessary for any healthy functioning cosmosphere or biosphere. And it also helps me make sense of my own divine nature, because I'm multiplicitous within my own self, right? I have different parts of my psyche, different parts of my personality, different parts of my physiology that all have separate functions, yet my work as a witch, as a magic worker, as a mystic is to hopefully bring those things into wholeness so that they can function together instead of at cross purposes. And I feel that that's a lot of the thrust of my magical work and the work of some of our magical communities is to try to bring things into wholeness so that even if they're disparate, they can function together instead of always working against each other. And therefore, hopefully, we're heading towards evolution rather than devolution. And that's enough for now.
Well spoken, Ms. Paxson.
I'm going to be very interested to see if we end up being unable to argue.
Yeah.
But I'm ready.
What we'll do about filling the time, I'm not sure in that case. Although I expect you all can think of something.
I was hoping you were a hard polytheist, Diana.
Yes and no. Are the gods many or are they one? Yes. Yeah. I have always believed that there is a zero. I like that. A great thou art that out there and in here and in there. Mystics touch that. Mystics in all religions have written about that unitary experience. And it's really, really cool. And then they come back, and they're still human beings in separate human bodies. And so although I'm absolutely certain that that-ness is there, it's not terribly useful. And the minute that a religion says it's going to be a monotheistic religion, and that there is only one God, and they know who it is, and you don't, and they... Soon as they start trying to work with it, they start personifying. And as soon, because that is how we are wired to relate. We relate to things as persons, to beings as persons. And it's inevitable, it's natural, and I think it's very useful. But what happens, of course, is that they then decide that their personification of deity is that great zero. And that, I think, is where they really go off the rails, which then goes on to our personification is the one right, true, and only personhood of that great zero, and yours isn't. But I've always had the view that there's a whole series of levels of discourse, so that how you're defining deity is going to depend on what level you're speaking at any given time. So there's one level at which it's the great whatever. There is another level at which you can separate it dualistically into male and female or any other set of two things that your particular religion goes for. Then you begin to get down to boxes, archetypes, and you will find goddesses of love and war tend to resemble each other a lot cross-culturally. They are not the same, however, because within their cultures you go down another level and you have the Greek version and you have the African version and so forth. And then even within those, especially if you look at Greek literature, you'll get epithets. If you look at Norse literature, Odin's got more names than anybody. If you look at the Afro-diasporic faiths, you have the paths of the Orishas, and each of those paths it has its own persona. And so you can be talking to and about any of those levels. You just have to be aware of which one you're talking to or about at any given time and not confuse them. And so you can say all the goddesses are one goddess, and we call her the goddess, and you're relating to the kind of feminine half of all that, or the god, and you're relating to the masculine half, except, of course, for those points where they get together, or kind of go off at a third tangent sometimes. The level at which most people relate to deity is pretty far down on the personification scale, because at least in my experience, that's the level at which we are relating when we're working magic. Because we can visualize it, we can focus on it, we can get a really good connection with it, and we can work with it. And so we experience our deities as persons. And there's in the book Pagans and Christians, he talks about what we call UPG. Well, he didn't call it UPG, but in heathen circles we call it, UPG is unsupported personal gnosis. If everybody in your community begins to get the same idea, then it becomes an unsupported general gnosis, and which makes a really unfortunate acronym. But that's probably how a lot of those widely accepted descriptions of deities came to be. Lots and lots of different people independently got the same idea about Thor having red hair or whatever. But in Pagans and Christians, he talks about people having visions, and somebody sees Dionysus wearing a saffron robe, and they make a shrine to him in their neighborhood, and in two neighborhoods over, the vision was a purple robe. Or maybe Dionysus just wanted more clothes, who knows? So you can have lots and lots of different facets without necessarily being wrong. And so even if it comes down to, well, this is the way that goddess presented herself to me, and this is what she told me she wanted for an offering, and so for my personal work and relationship to her, that's what I'm going to do. And as long as you go and try to impose that vision on everybody else, you're being a good polytheist. And if, in case nobody else mentions it, there's a book by John Michael Greer called A World Full of Gods which is a wonderful discussion of polytheistic theology. And the parable of the cats by itself is worth the price of the book.
Thank you. Christopher?
All right. Well, Thorne's description of this panel made me very intrigued because I thought, you know, God, one, zero, none, dualist, how do I describe myself? I think I started out believing in something. And when I figure out what that something is, as it goes along, I'll let you know. But I actually started out as a skeptic with magic, a skeptic with witchcraft, a skeptic with the gods. Coming from a Catholic background, I left as an agnostic and feeling there was something out there, but I couldn't quite pin it down, and I was very distrustful of anybody who could. So it's really even getting preparing for this panel and preparing for the panel that was on Friday night on theology. It was trying to figure out exactly what are the words that best describe me and how has that changed over the course of time. As I started in my development in witchcraft, and what really got me to a place of experiencing divinity was the sense of connection. I would say my first kind of initiatory experience into the mysteries of the gods wasn't very pagan. A lot of people will think about, you know, the experience they had with a particular deity or a particular ritual and how the gods spoke to them. But for me, it was a very psychic experience. And in that psychic experience, what really hit home for me was this idea that we were all connected. So that was the first place. You know, how could, it was a psychic healing and psychic diagnosis experience. And going into the training and kind of being the skeptic and, you know, chip on my shoulder that I had, I was like, there's no way this could work. And then I saw my teacher do it and said, okay, you know, that could work for her. There's no way I can do that. And when it did work for me, it just hammered home this idea that we are all connected. So that became this foundation block for me. And the theology that I got with these teachings and psychic experiences really had a hermetic base. It was a type of witchcraft tradition that really had that kind of hermetic foundation of the seven hermetic principles, and the one that always stuck with me was the principle of mentalism. We are all thoughts within the divine mind. And so I took that from a theological point of view, not just people, but we are all thoughts within the divine mind. This table is a thought within the divine mind. The trees are in the thought within the divine mind. Things that are intangible, that we can't lay a finger on and point to, are thoughts within the divine mind. And because we had minds as well, we were divine and we were creators. So that's kind of how it developed for me in trying to understand. But I was still very skeptical of the gods. I liked this idea of something, but not necessarily a personality to it. And then they started knocking on my door. And as they start knocking on my door, it was very hard. You know, a lot of people will say today, oh, how do I find my patron? I need to find my patron. And I'm like, you really don't need to find your patron. Let your patron find you. You know, sometimes it's more trouble than it's worth. But when they do, there's something that's resonant about that entity that we call a god with your life mission, your will, your purpose. So in the theology, I was calling this something that I believed in, the divine mind. And I think in ritual poetry, it came out as the great spirit because I just really liked that terminology. And the witchcraft tradition that I was working in was the Cabot tradition, and we talk about the goddess and the god as that duality. So I was thinking, am I non-dual? I believe in this great oneness, yet I believe in god and goddess and this kind of, as Diana was talking about, this level where everything is divided to male or female or whatever polarities you want to put to it, because there was another hermetic principle, the principle of polarity and the principle of gender, and all these things kind of started fitting into my worldview, yet these personal entities were coming out, and these particularly, it was a Celtic tradition, these, I have no Celtic blood, but these Irish gods were coming to me and saying, hey, you're ours. And so that kind of pressed upon this whole idea of individual personality. So within this great spirit, within this divine mind, I see a primal goddess, I see a primal god that has many facets in many ways as the, you go through the dimensions, whether you think of it as a shamanic sense of an overworld, how do the gods look, a middle world where we're at, and how does that look in an underworld, or if you think of it in the 10 spheres of the Kabbalah or the seven subtle planes, or however you divide reality, I think the gods exist on all those levels. You know, is the moon goddess in the physical world literally the moon? I think so. And does she manifest as more of a personality on a subtler level, on an astral level, on an emotional level? I think so. I've kind of evolved recently in my own visions and my own way of looking at things that the divine mind as that vast container in which we all are part of and connected to just doesn't summon up to me anymore. I have a tendency to be very mental. I don't laugh at that, but an idea of just being very in my head and really wanting to understand the ideas. And it's been my challenge over the last few years to get out of the head and get into the heart and get into the body and recognize the divinity in all these different levels. And so in some visions and experiences that I've had about divinity, I've started looking at divinity as triune. As I think that we are triune, I started looking at that model for divinity. And I think of it as there's a divine mind aspect that we're all a part of, and we're all thoughts within the divine mind, but we're also all emotions within the divine heart, and we're also that spark of flame within the divine will, and all those three things are existing concurrent in the same space, if we can say they're in a space, and we all have those three aspects ourselves, so they're reflections as above, so below. And for me, the theological word, I guess, that sums this up and understanding how I can be divine and how the gods can be a part of me is panentheistic. That's a word that just, once I kind of understood the definition of it, I was like, all right, that's where I'm coming from. And that simply means the divine is both immanent and physical and incarnated in the world and everything physical, whether it be constructed and crafted, whether it be out in nature, whether it be synthetic, is all a part of this divine entity. But it's also things that we think of as transcendent or non-incarnate, non-physical. So I can have an experience of divinity in a vision, in a shamanic journey, in a dream, and I can have an experience of divinity in the forest, in the field, in the parking lot. And that's the part people, you know, think that the divinity is in the forest, but it's not quite in the parking lot. And divinity is in the parking lot as well, you know? Divinity is in my car. Divinity is in the plane as I'm flying out here. So it's recognizing that all things are divinity. And as I start looking at it in terms of both being things I can point to and things that I can't point to, intelligences and ideas I can understand and things that are far beyond me, and realizing that all these things have that component of mind, of heart, and of will. And that's given me a greater grasp in trying to have relationship with both individual entities and how I see the greater whole. So that's where I'm at.
Thank you, Christopher. Evo?
Well, I'm a witch that's often accused of being a magician.
By me.
By you. But I guess what I would say is that my horror at this panel was trying to condense anything that our tradition believes this into a few words. How about this? As above, so below, you've heard it ad infinitum, ad nauseum, yes? So you're all microcosms of a macrocosm, though I would also insert a mesocosm, which is where the actual action takes place. At the beginning, which wasn't a beginning, there were things that pre-existed physicality and were consciousness, and there was a zero or a one, depending upon where we want to quibble. And then this world came into being and all the other worlds, and so did linear time and all those things that we move and live through. And what I would say is that there's a stream that is descending that is actually the eminent ones are the ones that are the gods and goddesses in the process of slowly becoming differentiated and becoming fully connected to the physical. And you and all the gods and goddesses that are the tribal gods and goddesses are those streams that are arising from the physical and are heading in the other direction, and many things mingling in between. For me, the gods and goddesses are as real as you are, but I will say that identity is extremely slippery. At the same time that I'm an individual, I also believe that all human beings are part of the same stream of consciousness, as I do for all elm trees, as I do for all wolves or anything else. And that our work is the work of becoming individually divine, but also eventually as things rise, they converge, and ultimately all humans will be one being that will be a divine being that is all humanity. And on the other hand, we had beings that pre-existed all physicality that are in their process of becoming more and more differentiated. So evolution is moving upwards and downwards. Moving towards matter is not devolution. The theosophists can go somewhere with that one. What I would say is that all the gods and goddesses are real. The question is, are they beings that started their sojourn as part of the totality and are coming from the eminent and descending, or are they beings that arose from physical evolution and through their process are becoming divine in a different way? And then there's a mingling in between the two, because I actually think that's the real polarity, not male and female, but the gods that are arising and the gods that are descending. And I'm using that word as a catch-all for the moment. So I would say that all the gods and goddesses are real, and they evolve, and they live, and they die in the same way that I believe that we as individuals go through many lifetimes. I believe the goddesses also die and are reborn, but their loop doesn't dip all the way down into physical matter, but stops at the subtle planes above or below us, so that they too are incarnating and reincarnating and collecting their experiences along the way. Everything that you know or conceptualize about your cycle of spiritual evolution is one and the same with theirs, and vice versa. So I agree and disagree with a lot of things that will probably be said by this panel. The one thing I will say is that my belief is that the great arrogance or the great falling away that monotheism had wasn't the idea of there being a oneness, though I like the idea of the zero as an alternative. It was the idea that any being that could be contacted by our level of human consciousness could actually represent the ultimate. Whatever plane of being the most evolved human on the planet...
I'm sorry.
Can't hear it? Is that any better? All righty. Any being that we could possibly commune with has to be within the ranges in which our consciousness remains lucid, in the same way that a mountain climber can only go so high before the air gets too thin for them to maintain clarity. There is only so high or so low, I hate the up and down thing, that your consciousness can reach and remain lucid and coherent. Any god and goddess that any of you have met is a local. The universe is much too vast for the scale of who we are at this moment. So I would say it's a much more complicated question than simply one or many. And to those that say, but my gods and goddesses are unique and different, this is to my friends who are Reconstructionist. Yes, they are, in the same way that I'm a unique individual for this lifetime. I guess I'll pass it on.
All right, thank you. And Lon?
I guess magic, am I on here?
Yes.
I guess magic is arranging so that you sit at the end of the table so four of your friends can say everything you want to say. So everybody, I agree. So. Actually, my wife, Constance, is back home in Costa Mesa, so I don't know what I think. But from my point of view, it's all about me. God is all about me. And, you know, they say that over the door of the mystery schools, chiseled in stone, were the words, know thyself. That's the first thing you learn, just as you're going into the mysteries. Know yourself. Well, fat freaking chance. Knowing yourself will be the last thing that you'll ever know. I know that in the nanosecond before I merge into ultimate Godhead, my last words will be, oh, that's what I am. So it is. It's. I have to think it's all about me. And were any of you at my talk yesterday? Well, the people that weren't there, turn to them and tell them what I said.
Likes to get drunk in the car.
And I feel very near God when that happens. But, you know, the older I get, the simpler things become. And I'm a simple man to begin with. And, you know, I see things, I see everything as an aspect of the big consciousness, the consciousness of the big what it is. I love that term for God, what it is. And this what it is just so big that there can be no opposite of the great big. And somewhere deep inside, and this is just a gut feeling, and I can have a big gut feeling, okay? That the nature, the ultimate nature of the Supreme Consciousness is ultimately good. But it's a good that is so big there can be no opposites to the great good. It's spelled with the biggest freaking G imaginable. And there is no room outside of the big good. There's not even room for nothing outside the big good. And so but until we reach that pssst, everything else is split up into littler things that do have opposites. And we have to deal with those as our personal level of spiritual evolution dictates. And everybody's different. And I don't think I could even communicate to you what page I am on. But I do have certain concepts that change from moment to moment, year to year, as I move along. And I've become comfortable with projecting the idea of the big good, the big supreme consciousness, the big supreme intelligence, and I can formulate it in my mind as a deity I can go into the presence of. And so I just pick the most comfortable deity to do that with. And at the moment, it's Ganesha. I love that little guy. And it may change tomorrow, okay? I mean, I'm a Thelemite and a magician and all work with all sorts of, deities and spirits and intelligences and stuff, but they're just a cascade of a hierarchy of different levels of consciousness, of natural forces. So, and I look at it that way. But when I want to be in the presence of the big what it is, it's just easy for me to walk into that throne room with that happy fat man's God, having him hand me that candy, you know. So I guess that's my talk.
Okay. So, thank you, Lauren.
You bet.
Would everybody like to applaud this nice panel? We're not going to open it up for questions, and if I could please, would you stand when you ask a question? And I'm sure that there must be some questions. Anybody?
Question.
Okay.
Well, I'm really struck by sitting up here with this distinguished panel, and I'm struck by hearing that on some level, with maybe some slight variation, we all agree on this non-dual, this, you know, big good, the what it is. And I'm wondering if we think this is something that has always existed in contemporary paganism, or if this is a shift. It's quite intriguing to me, because when I came in, not quite the Pleistocene age ago, but when I came in, there was a lot of emphasis on dualism, a lot of which dualism is helpful, also very non-helpful, especially around gender. I just need to state that, right? We are many, many, probably most of us, not binary genders. But a lot of emphasis on dualism, a lot of emphasis on hard polytheism, but even more emphasis on archetype. And a great discomfort with the non-dual, I found. And that discomfort with the non-dual seems to have abated. And I'm wondering what you all think about that.
Go ahead, Christopher.
I actually think it's almost the opposite from where I'm at, and it might be different coasts.
Now we get to argue.
Yeah, but it's not a theological, but just like a watching of what's happened. When I first got involved, which was arguably 15, 16 years ago, I felt it was much more Dion Fortune esque, all gods are one god, all goddesses are one goddess. And there was that polarity, but there was a sense of, well, there's polarity, but it really is all one, and there's a great web of life, and all things I believe deeply. But I feel like in the I'd say maybe the last 4 or 5 years or so, there's been a bigger shift. Like, when I got involved, there was not, nobody said hard polytheism.
Right.
You know, it was polytheistic or monotheistic, but nobody differentiated between hard polytheism and soft polytheism.
I think you're right.
And, you know, like now in the witchcraft communities, there's this new, well, it's not really a new term, but distinguishing Wicca from British traditional Wicca, from traditional craft, from heathenism, and people having these really strong labels of, well, you're a soft polytheist, and I'm a hard polytheist. Well, I'm a monist. Well, I'm panentheistic. Nobody was using, like, I was really scrambling for those words 15 years ago. So that I haven't seen.
I think you're right about that shift, too.
Yeah.
Do you have something?
Well, from the Reconstructionist end of things, which I suspect is where you're asking for hard polytheism, most people are not dual.
Okay.
In the Reconstructionist traditions, which have been flourishing quite fairly recently, relatively recently in the history of the reemergence of polytheist paganism, it's not so much that people don't necessarily believe in the great whatever, as that for the reasons that I gave earlier, they simply don't work with it. For practical purposes, and especially heathens tend to be very practical people, the day-to-day living and dealing with things, you work with the gods in their most personified aspect. And so you're working with them at that very individual level. And there's certainly much less division into gods and goddesses in the sense of you work with whoever will do the job that you need done at that point without worrying about whether they're male or female. And you don't, in at least in heathenry, you may have a ritual with a god and a goddess, or you may have a ritual with two gods or two goddesses or any combination thereof, and it's the functions that are the defining element rather than the gender.
I think that there's another thing going on. And perhaps I had the good fortune of growing up in a community, you know, in the early 80s where it was all one and the gods and the goddesses were differentiations of that. That was the starting point. What I've seen as the shift is in part more about the building of communities and identity than actually about the divine. Mm-hmm. The goddess and god forms, is that a term that people have as part of their bag of tricks? God and god forms? Anybody say no to that one? All right. How about this? To make the invisible man or invisible woman visible, you have to throw clothing on them. All the attributes that you give for the gods and goddesses, those are goddess and god forms, and they're created by people and cultures and are not inherent to the beings who are real in and of themselves. What I would say is that there are many people who are becoming very much enamored of the goddess and god forms rather than the beings themselves. So that at the same time that I'm all for devotion to whatever face of the divine calls to you or claims you, I'm a little concerned about the shift towards seeing those as a way of making them more real when really it's about staking territory for identity of communities rather than gaining deeper gnosis of who they might be. So I'd say that's the real shift I'm concerned about.
Mm, I'd agree with that.
I'd like to ask a question about that. Do you see any through that kind of practice? You know, when I think about it, do you think that this is the worship or the devotion to them has given any kind of sentient being or consciousness to them in those forms that you're talking about? You know, where they give a personality versus
here, Dan,
and anybody who'd like to.
Yeah, I've thought a lot about that. I was very struck by one particular comment that Dion Fortune made in one of her books, where she's talking about God forms, and the fact that the more people have actively visualized deity in a certain form with certain attributes, the more resonance, reality, whatever it has on the astral, and therefore the easier it will be the next time somebody tries to get in touch with that. And that not only does this hold true for the deities that we know historically, but any time a group of people start visualizing this vessel into which deity can pour itself, it can become a deity. And in my opinion, this has happened with Lady Liberty, for instance, because in the 19th century, they set her up to be a goddess, and the immigrants coming into New York Harbor, you know, can you imagine it? It's dawn and the fog parts, and suddenly there she is, and they go, oh, she must be the goddess of the New World. And then everything you needed for a deity cult is all there. There's the pilgrimage place, and there's the badges and the souvenirs. It's all there. And then more recently, I started working with the founding fathers as Alfar, as ancestor figures, because in 2004 was when I started doing this. It seemed to me that they might have an interest in working with us to preserve what they set up. And the whole setup for the cult is there, you know. There's a shrine. There are souvenirs. The only thing that needed to be added was the libations. So I went around and poured out brandy. I figured nobody had given Jefferson a drink for a good long time. So you can work with them that way, and that's been fascinating. So I think that this does happen, and as different gods and goddesses become popular, the more people who are visualizing them in the same way, the stronger that set of clothes becomes.
Thank you. Thank you. I'll start over here. If you would please stand so everybody can hear your question.
For years in this community, I assume that the defining thing that held all us pagans together, or those who define themselves as pagan, was that we believed that, while we believed in different gods and goddesses, that ultimately we believed everything was connected, or as you say, Thor and the ultimate zero. So my question is particularly addressed to Lon, because I believe that until I ran into some hardcore ceremonialists that said, nonsense, everything's not connected, you've got to deal with things separately. And there's no underlying connection. So I'm wondering what you think of that.
I'm a heretic.
We love that about you.
We love our heretic stuff.
No, it's like that. Everything has to be connected. Okay, and I think that's the whole thing about these tables of correspondences and all of the tight-ass, stainal, retentive stuff that ceremonial magicians are into. it's just trying to make a temporary method out of the madness of everything being connected. So, no, I didn't have a problem with that. And concerning the whole kind of question in general, I didn't come out of the pagan community. Mm-hmm. I came out of... I was a Methodist atheist, and then I took LSD. and I don't know what the heck I am, but because it's all about me, the Thelema thing fit really well with me. You know? So I see all sorts of, you know, phases of coming and going, and I'm really not that qualified, because I'm not really a hardcore member of the community as such. But what I do see is a disturbing, at least for me, tendency to use all of these different separate little identities to form little cul-de-sacs, mm-hmm, of fundamentalism.
Yes.
And that can be really wild, especially as they develop through generations of people that didn't understand where the founding fathers of the cul-de-sac were coming from. So.
Christopher, would you like to comment?
Yeah,
I think one of the things that's really interesting about this panel and all of us, and to use a word that Thorne's been using a lot about mystic, I guess that applies to me in some ways, but I think looking at all of us in different levels, mystic applies to us, but I don't think all pagans or all magicians or all witches or whatever word you want to use also consider themselves mystical. Some people here are looking, and not just Pantheon, but I mean in the greater all community, are looking for community. They're looking for social networks, they're looking for support, they're looking for worldviews that support whatever experiences they've had, but they're not always seeking to understand and commune and be a part of. So I found just the more people enter into the mystical, the more a lot of the labels, like, you know, people say, oh, do you think you're all going to be fighting on this panel? I think the more mystical you are, the more you, that kind of sheds away, and you're like, oh, I can see that point of view and see those underlying connections. But to assume that's a default in the pagan community or magical communities, that hasn't been my experience, you know?
Would you like to comment at all or no?
Just real briefly, and that is that the question
is, if you are trying to connect with a particular god or goddess or being that represents a force or a power, then it's really valuable to have those images, those tables of correspondences, in the same way that you need an IP address or an email address or a phone number, as long as you remember that that's all that it is. And even though I was raised Catholic and idolatry is kind of okay in Catholicism, I think that the issue is to remember that this is just a way to key into that particular being and not to confuse that collection of things that's temporary. Temporary is maybe 50 years, 100 years, 200 years, 2,000 years. It's still temporary. So that as long as we know that the little icons that we click on our internal computer screen to connect with the divine is not the divine, then it's all good. Mm-hmm. And that's the place where I worry about the cul-de-sacs that Lon spoke of.
Yeah, if I can just add a little bit. I occasionally attempt to use that computer metaphor, even though I don't really know what I'm talking about. But when you turn on your computer and you start typing commands in, you are not communicating with what's really going on in the computer. The electrical energy is moving around in some arcane way. But you're working with a program, and then that's working with about two or three other levels of programming before you actually ever get to the ones and zeros, which is maybe the dualism part. And then beyond that, there's this electrical energy that's moving around. You know, I can't talk to that, even when I'm in a meditation. But I talk to my program, and if I'm lucky, I'm communicating correctly.
And I want to comment on two things. One, I'd like to say I sometimes bemoan that it was a lot easier when we were all just the occult. However much, you know, some of us don't like that word or whatever, we all knew we were under the same roof and had to deal with each other.
Right.
But the other thing I want to talk about with, you know, dealing with God forms and being a mystic is, yes, I am a mystic. Yes, the non-dual is my ultimate truth and reality. And I have altars all over my house. I commune with separate deities all the time. I have conversations with them in my head. I had a great argument with Ganesh in a shop once over which statue he preferred.
The more expensive one.
The more expensive one, yes. Yeah, yeah, we had quite an argument about that. Had an argument just this weekend with my main deity contact about what color we wanted to wear that day, because he wanted this particular color, but the shirt was too femmy for my energy that morning. Oh, you can see the morning I had. Right? So I experience directly the non-dual, and I love the specific. You know, yes, I do have the great mystic cell dissolving orgasmic light in extension states. I love it. I get a lot of information there. And you know what? Specific tongues, fingers, and skin are really, really hot. So specific gods, I'm for them.
Go ahead, Estella.
Where do y'all feel the deities want us as a race to go next?
Who'd like to start?
Let's all take a breath.
Diane, I saw you chuckle first.
Okay, I don't think I wouldn't care to assume that the deities, as a group, necessarily agree on that any more than we do. My own experience with my primary deity, who is Odin, and whom I experience as a god of consciousness, and all of the different kinds of consciousness and ways of thinking he seems to be particularly interested in, and what I get from him, again, this is his take on things, is that the Western mode of consciousness and the scientific method have done some really cool things, and he really enjoyed hanging out with the development of physics and the rest of it. But now we need a new mode of consciousness, and because if we don't get it, Ragnarok is going to come too soon, and he doesn't like that idea. So one reason I think he's been kind of popping up all over the place and landing on people who had no intention of ever dealing with the Norse gods in general, and him in particular, is that he's desperate to get us to start thinking in new ways and getting back to harmony with the earth and the rest of it. And there's a whole other rant there that I won't go into.
Okay, Eva?
Very quickly, I don't believe in big plans. I think that there are many sincere, well-meaning people that you know, and as above, so below, who have their idea of if we arrange the politics this way, if we arranged our activities this way, what a beautiful, wonderful world it would be. And having been a refugee from many leftist politics where we split hairs infinitely, I can tell you.
People from Judea.
Yeah. I can tell you that it is my belief that the gods and goddesses, all of different sizes, all of different levels of perspective on the whole, each have, within individual gods or goddesses, or within pantheons or streams of consciousness, their own ideas of what the best possible way it is to assist those human beings and their poor struggles on the earth. And they don't all agree, and none of them are right. And if you believe in omni-anything, omniscient, omnipotent, omni-anything, then you've fallen into old thinking patterns. None of them know the right answer. None of them. They are bigger than us, wiser than us, but they still don't know where we're headed either. So what I would say is, you hitch your star to the ones that you think are closest to the right work for you. But I don't think that there is a plan.
Christopher?
I think equally a good question would be to ask, well, where do we want to go with the gods? Yeah. You know, it's like thinking, well, where does my mom or my dad think I should be going? And am I going to listen to that? Absolutely. But I'm a being of free will. I have my own god self. I'm evolving. And it's trying to figure out what can we do in cooperation. And sometimes our path takes us a little bit away from the ones that we perceive as wise or parental or divine. And it doesn't make our path necessarily wrong. But it's figuring. I'm a big believer in cooperative effort. Mm-hmm. So a lot of times when we're talking about deity and patrons, I just know a lot of people have this idea that they're totally surrendering their will to an entity. I believe in surrendering your will to your divine will. Mm-hmm. And if you find an entity that's in harmony with that divine will, then that's how you go forward. But I think sometimes a lot of people are also looking to absolve themselves of the responsibility of making choices in their lives. Mm-hmm. And that's always kind of a warning trigger. So I would also think, well, what can we do together rather than what do they want of us? What do we want of them? What do they want of us?
And Thorne?
I really agree with that. It's incumbent upon us to find our work and be co-creators. And, you know, fairy tradition puts it, we need to find the work of this god, meaning our divine self. What is our true will, as it would be said in Thelema? And I agree with Ivo, then, what relationships support my true work in the world? And that's true of my human relationships, my work relationships, and my deity relationships. If anything's getting in the way of my true work in the world, the work of this god, it's not a relationship that's healthy for me.
Come on. Would you like a comment?
I agree.
go with you.
Sir Stan.
Okay. I'm just thinking about this Cartesian split that you're talking about. So you have this dualistic notion. And in that notion, we have things like mind and body. And we have things like the spiritual and the physical. And what happens to me with like the Christian regime that we've lived under for quite some time, those things get polarized so that one is valued over the other. And a lot of the discussion, certainly not all of it, but a lot of the discussion has spoken in terms that are extremely head and upwards. Whereas also deity, to me at least, is that very physical, not only embodied but of the flesh, and gods are flesh and gods are earth. And so all of that is part of that divinity and inclusive. And if you could talk perhaps to that for a moment.
You're shaking your head.
Well, thanks a lot for that comment. We have been speaking a lot about the non-corporeal. And yet, many of us experience and believe that the sacred is right here. You know, the sacred is in the trees. So what is the God of that tree? Just like, what is your God? You know, what is the God in the tree? What is the God in the statue in downtown Portland, Oregon? You know, Portlandia, that people do pilgrimage to, right? I think it's really easy to think in abstractions because it makes us more comfortable, because as long as deity, even though we have this concept that deity is immanent, as long as we shift our consciousness and thinking more towards the abstract, we can remain more comfortable in our lives as they are rather than constantly divinizing our lives. So how do I divinize my existence? How do I divinize my relationships with everything around me, with the natural world, with my own body, you know? So yeah, we say, oh yes, my body is sacred, but oh, it's okay because our overculture hates our bodies. We can remain in that training and enculturation to hate our bodies. Well, what does that say about my relationship to divinity? You know, if I am not doing my best to treat my body as a sacred, living, divine being, what does that say for the future of the soil that's getting poisoned? You know, the water and air that's getting poisoned. It's all part of that the same systems that desacralize. So I think what I hear beneath your question is the consciousness we can have that resacralizes everything, that brings us into right relationship.
Christopher?
For me, you know, we're talking about all this very heady theological stuff, but one thing we haven't really been talking a lot about, and I think it includes all of us, is that we're all magical practitioners.
Right.
And magic is not necessarily something you think about. It is. Often we like to talk about magic, but magic is something you do. And to me, that's a big part of my spirituality. Although magic can be practical, and it's great to get magic to, you know, have a job and to get sex and to have a smooth life, those things are all sacred. They're not separate. And whether it be an act of magic to commune with the highest levels of deity that I can understand, or whether it's the magic to get the parking spot at the mall at Yule Time shopping, mm-hmm. to me, that's all sacred. But it's something that you do, and it's in that conscious action. And one of the things that has always stuck with me that a teacher had said, that every thought that you think, so on that mental level, every word that you say, which is still kind of a mental level brought into the physical world because somebody's hearing it, and every action you take, whether that action be a rite of high magic or whether that be, you know, going to the bathroom, every action you take is that sense of divinity, and as divinity is in that moment. It's an action of magic. It's an expression of your will and your intention is not separate from your divinity. So I think the more I start to look at everything that I do, every thought that I think, every word that I say, every action that I take as an act of magic, and magic is the way that I enact my spirituality, that's been a very important part. It started out as a good idea that I couldn't quite fathom to, and then it's just keeping that thought in mind and having that awareness with everything that I do has shifted my relationship with very common and mundane things to see the sacred in every moment. Every person I'm talking to is God talking back to me. You know, but keeping that in mind, even when God's being an asshole, you know, so it's through that person, I'm just like, oh, this isn't a pleasant experience, but this is an aspect of divinity coming towards me and realizing that even in those moments that are not grand in that moment is an act of divinity. So that's how I kind of bring it into the physical.
Okay.
One of the things you learn from studying the folk traditions of just about every culture is that everything is people. And in Shinto, you have a surviving system where the kami, a kami is a being, and a being can be anything from an ancestor to the spirit of that rock to anything that has an identity has a spirit. In the North, it was a white, W-I-G-H-T, not to be confused with W-H-I-T-E. So you live in a world in which everything is a being or has a being associated with it. The boat has a being, the house has a being. You make an offering to your house white at festivals. And so you're living, your community suddenly expands incrementally, and you're living surrounded by all of these things which have spirits, and you relate to them. You relate to your car, to your computer. In fact, a friend of mine asked, is it ethical to sell your car without telling the buyer that you're a witch? Because so many of us have kept our cars going by developing a relationship with the spirit of the car, you know. And it's that kind, I think that may be the kind of magical thinking. It really, if you wrap your head around seeing the world as a place where everything has spirit that you're relating to that way, it really changes the way you walk in the world.
Ivo or Ron, would you like to comment, or shall we take another question?
Let's take another question.
Okay. Alicia, would you
say that? I've got another question about magic, and it goes along with the whole theme of dualism, because it's like whether you look at the deities and us, or you see it as a huge continuum, where do they come in magic? I mean, I read over and over in manuscripts and books that people are like, oh, doing a spell is like a prayer. You know, except it's to a specific deity and you use some of their favorite things, like their favorite incense or their flower or their color. But how much of that is from inside and how much is from outside? And does it make a difference? So just want to comment on that.
Long, go ahead.
There is no outside of you. For all intent and purposes, there is no outside of you. Did you ever, when you were a kid, go out in the front yard at night and lay down and look up at the stars and think, am I the only one in the world? Am I just dreaming my parents? Can I just freaking wake up? But for all practical purposes, there is no outside of yourself. Even on a very practical level, everything that you perceive, you're still going to have to process inside yourself. So from a magical perspective, it's all yours. All the gods, all the goddesses and the angels and the archangels and the hierarchy of spirits are all just little sections of you. Not only that, but you're responsible for your own misery. You're responsible for your own happiness. And you can never make yourself any happier than you can make yourself right now. And so if you're feeling sort of bummed out and go, well, I think I'll have a god tell an archangel to tell an angel to order a spirit. Well, you can go ahead and do that. It's a mechanism. It's a technique. It's an art form. Magic is an art form. And not everybody is an artist in the same way. Okay. And so you're just going to have to find your own way of doing that pleases your sense of magical art. And another thing is, don't ask a magician why they're doing this. Okay. Who knows? You're an artist, you know. Did you go to Baryshnikov and say, well, why do you dance? You know, there is no answer. And ultimately, it's all inside yourself. So, objective, subjective, yes.
Long, Long, am yeah. I you?
Well, I'm sure I'm here, but I'm not sure about you guys. Okay.
Really, though, according to what you just laid out, am I you?
Yes.
You all heard it here today. G. Thorne Coyle is really Lon Milo Duquette.
And I'm so glad I whipped you up.
Well done, Lon.
Tell me if this is going to get us hideously off topic, but I get real twitchy when the conversation goes to you make your own suffering.
Oh, okay.
That's,
yeah, a little bit off topic.
That's okay.
Let's
go for it.
Just say some
go
of us.
Go for it.
Many of us question that.
Yes. No. Go ahead.
But you are responsible for how you process that suffering.
Yes.
That's right.
Mm-hmm. And if it wasn't kind of, I don't look at time even as a linear forward marching thing. And I really don't know of anything, including diseases that I developed as a child. Did I really deserve to have Hipperthes disease and things like that when I was a child? But the older I get, and as I near the end, I feel like I'm nearing the beginning. I feel like Benjamin Button, okay? And that it seems like I'm more and more responsible for things that I thought I was more and more out of control of. And it's just my take on the situation.
Well, I would agree that unless, if we are healthy enough to be in control of our thoughts, mm-hmm. that we are responsible for what we choose to do about the things that happen to us. Mm-hmm. And we are certainly responsible for making choices about what we do to others. And that whole personal responsibility thing is very, very important. But there are, shit happens.
There are toxic waste dumps.
Yeah, you know, we are not personally responsible for everything that has happened in the world. We may be responsible for deciding to do something about the toxic waste dump and paying attention, and that there are things in our families and our local communities and the larger communities and the world, you do have to choose where best to use your energy. Mm-hmm. Because if you sit there and go, I am responsible for every dying child in Africa, you're just going to sit there and gibber. You have to choose and take some action that's actually possible. Choose one dying child in Africa to send money to. Choose one national park to do conservation in. Try to come up with some kind of practical approach and be responsible for your own choices.
Yeah, I'm going to try to tie together stuff that makes sense relative to this discussion and Alicia's question. I would agree, I would do yes, no. No, everything is not inside me. Yes, everything is. And in the same way that you have the generalized concept of as you rise on the planes, up and down is crappy, but we'll go there. As you rise on the planes, the vibration is higher, density is less, blah, blah, blah. Form is less restrictive. I would say that the farther away you are from this place, that the less boundaried and the more everything becomes one. And the closer you are to here, the more boundaried and the more articulated into separate interconnected pieces they are. So that depending upon the magic that I want to do, for example, if I do weather magic and I do it with careful advisement, I don't bother with gods and goddesses. I bother with the local nature spirits. No. If it depends on the nature of the work, so you choose the right modality for the outcome desired. And as to how that relates to not everything crappy that happens to me is my direct responsibility, well, I may have chosen to be born into this particular life, blah, blah, blah. I believe that. But I also believe that karma and manifestation functions very much like celestial mechanics, the concept of mass and gravity really works, and we are all different lumps of clay of different sizes with a different amount of impact on the space-time around us, so that larger beings, and larger doesn't mean more girth.
Thank you.
But you are kind of a hottie the way you are, but that's okay. But larger beings, meaning more focused consciousness, more unified consciousness, gives you more pull than another human being. But if there are 10 million other human beings that are acting in a particular way, your power and will is encumbered as you're trying to pass through this frame of reference. So there is an interaction. And the more you become one with yourself, the more power you have to act against whatever the pervading tide is.
I agree with Ivo, and another facet I'd like to make more explicit vis-a-vis the question is that part of our magic is a process of tuning. Tuning ourselves, tuning our intention, tuning our energy. And so the adept may or may not do as much physical magic, you know, because the tropes of will tuning are so ingrained, you know, that it's easier now to just focus our energy, move forward in a moment. However, using the material is fun, and it's a meditative practice. So I'm tuning myself not only with material goods, but I'm also tuning with whatever deity feels like it's a good harmony, you know? If I want more abundance in my sex or money life, Frey and Freya are really good people to tune to, really good entities to tune to, because they have a long history of singing that song. So why wouldn't I want to tune myself to that? And that's quite different to me. And that's about their relationship over time and then my relationship with them. It's quite different than what I like to call the goddess du jour that some pagans use, which drives me crazy. I have no relationship with this being and this entity. I've never even asked them out for a cup of tea, but I'm going to call them up and demand they do work for me because so-and-so said that so-and-so, a god, was good for XYZ working. You know what? That's just rude. Right? So I want to establish relationship. And, you know, it's just like if I have a project that I need help on, I'm going to call up a friend I know who has that skill set. And that's how this magical relationship with deity can work for me. And it makes it more effective.
Okay. Let's take another question. Let me go back there.
This actually relates to what Thorne was just saying. You know, I think there's a temptation with the non-dual aspect to say this intermediate relationship with God, isn't really real. And so you have this technology like Libra Astarte. I'm going to date the god very passionately for a while, and just as soon as I've attained, I'm going to break up just to prove that that's a blind. And I'm curious to hear the opinions here of the difference between that and maybe the opposite end of the polarity, which is building these lifelong relationships, and how both of those approaches relate to the ultimate non-dual.
Anyone?
Well, I've already made my comment on that, that, you know, I'm a great non-dual mystic, and I want to have individual relationships. Individual relationships teach me something specific that connecting to the non-dual doesn't teach me. You know, I want this, in my tradition we talk about the center and the circumference, right? I want to pay attention to both of those things. I want to be as inclusive as possible. So therefore, I want all gradations of relationship out to complete extension, you know? And some days, you know what? I'm just not there with the extension, and I really want that specific. So
It is. I can see where psychologically it's... Okay, I'm going to go even more concrete here. People are fond of saying, the only tool the magic worker needs is her body. Well, yes, that's true. However, while I'm establishing relationship with various energies, I really need to know what it feels like to pick up a knife. And I really need to know what energy is held in a cup and what the function of that cup is. So that, again, is about concrete, specific relationship, even though they are also symbolic of larger, more abstract forces. So it's the same with any other relationship. I want specific deity along with my relationship with the non-dual. And, you know, the other thing about specificity, if I can speak in English, is that it helps me in this world. It helps me to communicate. When I'm in my blown-out mystic state, I'm speaking in tongues, and it communicates to no one but me. So if I want to communicate my experience, I need to get more specific. I need to have relationships that are closer in.
Christopher? I think in some ways, it also gets to what labels we're using for ourselves. We've been throwing around mystic a lot. We're at a arguably neo-pagan magical context here at Pantheacon. But each of those words, where we think of ourselves as priest, priestess, mystic, magician, seeker, they all have different connotations to them, and there's a lot of overlap, but not all of us might have the same goal in the same moment. You know, some people who might, and this is gross generalization, but some people who might be thinking just solely as a mystic are looking for that union with the non-dual, with the whole, and they're not necessarily concerned about those relationships. And then people who also identify as a priest or priestess, those individual relationships to individual gods is very paramount, because I know if I don't have those relationships, it's very hard for me to then minister to my community, let alone myself. You know, some people are looking at it strictly as a technology and have this view of deities and god forms as just the technology of ritual and the way of interfacing with the universe, but it's not personal, it's convenience. And I've gone through all of those phases. You know, and in different times, it served different places. I know for me, in figuring out a little bit better of what my mission is, I do want to have that union, but I also do want to have those personal relationships, because those personal relationships are part of my service. I'm a priest not just to my community, but to the gods that I serve, and there's that cycle and interaction. And one of the things we haven't really expressed a lot today is about the, I don't want to say the price of it, but the exchange. Thorne had mentioned respect. And it's not just respect, but if you're entering a relationship with these individual entities that we're calling gods and goddesses, they're doing things for us, they're doing work for us, but not necessarily always out of the sheer joy of doing that work for us. You know, I mean, why are they working so hard for us? What do they get out of it? That's a good question to ask yourself. And if you haven't had the opportunity where then they've asked of you, that's an important thing. One of my pet theories, and I don't know if it's right or wrong, is, you know, when we first get into mysticism and magic, there's this whole sense of speaking to the spirits, to the gods, to the angels, and they're doing all this stuff for us, you know? And I think they're really doing it in the sheer hope that out of every 10 of us they help, one of us won't screw up, and we'll actually be able to do something for them and make the world a better place and be that bridge between the worlds and that interface. But they know they have to get us to a certain level, so that's why they're trying to help us with all our work, in a hope that we will then be of service to them, whatever label that we have. But there's a lot of people who don't want to enter into those relationships. I remember having a very specific time in my life where I worked very deeply with the Egyptian gods. And that's not necessarily where my path is now, but the interesting thing was that none of my teachers told me is then the Egyptian gods came to me and said, hey, we want you to do this. And they actually wanted me to speak to someone who they felt that they had touched, and this person wasn't interested in magic or mysticism in any shape or form. She was in a very bad place in her life. It was somebody I worked with when I had a normal straight job. And they wanted me, for all the advice and work they've done for me, to go to her and say, hey, have you heard about Bast? Bast would really like to meet you, and there's a technique that I should teach you. And she looked at me like I was crazy. But for them, it was just the contact of opening that door. And when I met this woman after we both left the job 7 years later, she was just like, you know, that always stuck with me. And I started looking into Egyptian spirituality. I don't know how far she pursued it, but it was a door for her after she went through a big drug addiction phase. But it was very embarrassing at the time, and that was that price. You know? So just because they're doing all this work for you, they can set forces into motion that we can barely understand on some levels. But at the same time, we're very tangible. The woman that they needed to talk to couldn't hear them. She could hear me. I was in the right place at the right time. So you might be asked for that. So that's part of the relationship. And some people who pursue magic or mysticism don't necessarily want to take that responsibility. I understand why. It depends where you come from that.
If I may, I'd really like to hear from Lon, because part of why I asked the question is that I keep encountering this concept in reading Crowley. And I'm trying to integrate that with the deep, lifelong relationships I do build with my deities. So I'm really curious to hear the Thelemic take on this.
Well, I don't speak for Thelema, okay? And anyone who says they do, run, okay? But that the particular piece of literature or ritual that you were talking about, Liber Astarte, it's the ritual she's talking about is... a devotional ritual. It was Crowley's version of Bhakti Yoga, okay, where you choose a deity and just love it to death. Mm-hmm. As a matter of fact, love it to your death. Mm-hmm. And the theory behind it, it's wonderful. It's well written. It's passionate. But just look at all of the freaking relationships that Crowley had, love relationships, and tell me, is this the right guy to tell me how to do this? Okay, and it's fine. But you mentioned the fact that after wearing all of the colors she loves and eating the food she loves and singing the song she loves, and after you get her, you dump her. That's not exactly how I read that ritual, you know. Although, you know, Crowley probably, once he got what he wanted, would just as soon have her turned into a pizza, you know. And just, but I don't really see it like that. And I'm not that cold-blooded. Crowley's left hemisphere was so big he had to wear special hats. And I'm sort of a feel guy. You know, and I have to slip into it a little different way. So read Crowley for yourself, and don't so much rely on how other people will interpret that for you. And that's my Thelemic advice. Although you can buy my book.
We have a few minutes left.
Pressure, just a little bit of pressure. That's there. Right. The idea of non-dualist seems to bring up to mind that non-essential portion or component, except for souvenirs, obviously, because I think that's universal to all the. How that collapses down to no center, and how do we build community around something that we? No center. How do we get to that point? Or do we just get into non-essentialism, which goes on to a multiplicity of nothing but essentialism in a multifaceted way?
I think I actually have an answer to that.
Okay, you can go right in.
Thank God.
Now, and I may be mishearing your question, but pretend that you're walking through an art gallery and you're admiring these amazing paintings. And the artist is in disguise at the gallery because they want to hear the real comments that people have to make about the art. And actually, obviously, I'm talking about the artist is actually a goddess or god. And there are a bunch of people that are going around going, dude, wow, oh, and the goddess or god goes, oh, pitter-pat, it makes me so happy that they enjoy this. And after a while, they grow tired of that. They grow tired of that until they walk around and find this one individual over here. I like the way that the motion starts in this corner and moves here, and it looks like it's going inward, and how the colors pull it back and forth at the same time. And they start talking about it in exquisite understanding detail. Then that god or goddess is happy. So at the same time that there might be a desire to reach for, you know, ultimate connection, the only way that the gods or goddesses experiences any praise or any understanding that their work has meant anything is when we achieve the level of knowledge that allows us to begin to understand what they're about. So I think that even from my perspective, you can't be a good mystic unless you're all about everything. Knowledge, art, beauty, the body, so that the answer is, yes, that might be the direction, but they don't want you to show up at their doorstep going ooh and ah and drooling. They want us to be everything here first.
Okay, everybody. Well, we want to thank you all for coming today, and wasn't this a fabulous panel?
I hope you enjoyed that lively theological discussion. And I hope it gives us all food for thought that we can take back to our communities and keep expanding pagan and magical theology and deepening our practices together. And once again, this is Elemental Castings T-Thorn Coil at thorncoil.com. Now also the artist known as Lon Milo Duquette. Take care and blessed be.
And rock solid, oh you lovers, stand with me. Hey. Right.